All your favorite CBC podcasts are now available on YouTube. The best in award-winning true crime investigations, hilarious comedies, vibrant pop culture conversations, and even more audio series are all available on CBC Podcast's YouTube channel. You'll also find exclusive video first episodes, YouTube shorts, and behind-the-scenes content from our hosts and producers that you can't find anywhere else. So if YouTube is your go-to source for podcasts, just search CBC Podcasts and hit subscribe, and you'll never miss the latest update.
This is a CBC podcast.
So Tegan and Sarah are these legendary musicians from Calgary. They are also twins. And in our conversation today, they tell me something about being a twin. I'm not a twin. They tell me something about a twin that I never would have thought of before. And it kind of completely changed the way I think about twins. They'll also talk about starting over in the music business with a new team and a new label and the changes they wanted to make going forward. That's coming up. Plus, Sean Togood will tell you that people come up to him in the grocery store with tears in their eyes and they say stuff like, "You are a hero. I'm praying for you." Sean finds that all very, very funny. Sean, who has cerebral palsy, has a very funny new TV show called You're My Hero about those strange and awkward and uncomfortable things people say to him in the run of a day. I'm Tom Power. You are listening to Q. Let's start out by listening to some music.
Smoking weed alone, I'm in the woods. Wonder if I'll get clean again. Running down the street, it's just a dream. Think I need to wake up again. 'Cause the light, yeah, the light in my eyes is down. And the stars in the sky, well, they look so dull. All the miles that I've walked off, adding up. And I'm tired, so tired of it, adding up.
It's Tegan and Sarah and a song called Smoking Weed Alone, a song that I definitely don't relate to. And a song that kind of talks about where Tegan and Sarah are in their lives right now. Let me just give you a brief outline of them if you're not as familiar with them. They're twins from Calgary. They start making records, like these little demos at their home. They get signed to a record label. They make these records that are just great and important, especially for women and for queer folks. And then they have these massive pop hits. Then they release a book about their lives growing up. Then there's a big TV show based on that book. Which leads to an interesting time to talk to Tegan and Sarah, because I think after looking back for so long, they're starting to think about what's ahead. So we talked about that. In particular, how hard it might be to like change direction in your careers. They're still young musicians. When you feel this weight of this body of work you've already done. A really interesting conversation about legacy with young musicians. Here's my conversation with Tegan and Sarah. I have some questions I've been wanting to ask you for a long time because I haven't seen you in a long time. And I haven't seen you since the last time I talked to you was when the book came out. And I haven't seen you since the TV show came out based on. So for people who don't know, there's a show, High School, where they are played by. And remind me the names of the twins who play you.
Season and Rayleigh.
Season and Rayleigh.
Gilliland.
Sarah, I'll start with you. What is it like to watch the TV version of yourself?
You know what was so interesting is that getting off of the sort of promo circuit of talking about the book and then, you know, and then finding out, okay, we're going to get to make this TV show. You know, there's a lot of top line sort of narrative that you sort of like push a lot, like, oh, you know, this is a story about queer women and we're artists and we don't normally get to read that or see that or, you know, blah, blah, blah. But one of the first sort of most shocking realizations I had when we started filming High School, the TV show based on our years of high school, I don't know anything. I've never watched anything with twins. As a twin, I felt like the gap, I guess, in some ways that this fills for me as the viewer or as the, you know, as the individual watching it, was that I was profoundly moved by watching twins, even if it hadn't even been based on our life. Like, here were twins that looked like me or who acted like me. Like, there's you know, been versions of twins that I've, like, I don't know, like I'm thinking about like The Parent Trap or like Sweet Valley High or I don't know, whatever the twin shows have been.
Yeah.
They've been these very specific and narrow sort of you know, I don't know, characterizations that didn't necessarily relate to me. But here I was, a twin, watching at 42 years old, a twin. Twins on screen that reminded me of us who were literally playing us.
Tell me more about that. Like, what was missing that about, because I'm not a twin, what was missing in the twin dynamic that was in your show that maybe wasn't in other stuff?
I mean, I think that there's a sort of, like simplified, dumbed down version of twins that Tegan and I have certainly struggled with as we've sort of like battled through our own personal lives and professional lives, like this idea that we can like, it sounds like a very simple thing on the surface. Like, oh, what happens when you're a twin? Okay. Everybody mixes you up all the time. Mm-hmm. They can't remember your name. They almost don't even try to remember your name when they find out you're twins. Cause they're just like, whoopsie daisies. I won't be able to tell you apart. Now on the surface, that sounds like silly, even sweet, quaint, whatever. But imagine, Tom, that you have gone your whole life and no one remembers what your name is, or if you have, there's another person out there in the world that people are always confusing you with, and they think you can read that person's mind and that you share all the same opinions and feelings and thoughts. And in some ways it's been a very disorienting and sometimes frustrating way to go through the world, because it's like maybe when you're 3 years old, it's funny, but when you're 42 and people are like, whoopsie daisies, what's your name? Her, that one over there. I don't know, whatever. You start to feel like, oh my God, do I exist? And, you know, am I substantial? Do I, you know, am I being taken seriously? Whatever it is. And so I think the representation of twins in my life has always sort of been like, it's either simplified in this like goofy, like mind reading, dress the same sort of silly Doubleman twins kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or there's an exploitation, sexual, incestuous thing that happens a lot with twins, that especially as female twins, Tegan and I have had to deal with a lot. And so to watch a sort of tender, sophisticated portrayal of twins who are extremely different from each other, who are having really, they're both extremely close, and then going through this very difficult stage of development where they are pulling away from each other, all of these kinds of things. Like, it was just, for me as a twin, the first time I got to see that on screen, and that it was also representative of our own story. Obviously it was very profound and at times moving, really, really moving.
Let me just hold on to that for a second. So I really appreciate what you're saying. I had never thought about the depictions of twins that I've seen in pop culture until now. And I can see it. I can see the problems you would have had with it. I also want to point out that a book is written by the two of you. And a TV show is made by a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. I know that part of the answer is, oh, we put our trust into the right person and we talk to this person and we love them and we trusted them to tell our story. But Tegan, I'll go to you on this. Is there any, like, we are really giving the story of our lives to people who are not us?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Absolutely. And I don't think we understood that fully. I think we thought we understood that. When we finished writing our memoir, like when it was getting ready to be published, it was published in September 2019. Yeah. So in the months leading up to that, we sent early versions, you know, that were, you know, still being fact-checked and edited to people for blurbs. Like, so you send it out, like, you know, Dan Levy wrote one and Elliot Page. And we sent one to our friend Clea Duvall, who's a writer and director, but also known to be a wonderful actor. She was in But I'm a Cheerleader. She was on the TV show Veep. And we've known each other. We've been friends forever. She's come on holiday with us. Like, she spent many Christmases with us. So she's not just any old friend. Like, she's someone who's sort of infiltrated the sort of inner family of Tegan and Sarah as well. And when we sent her the book, she said she would blurb it. But she also called me the next morning and said, I was up all night reading this book, and I think you guys should make this into a TV show and don't just sell it. Like, you know, a lot of people just sell the rights to their books and they have nothing to do with developing them for TV. And, you know, I felt so confident that because we knew Clea, that it would be an easier process than if we went to somebody else. Like, we never had any intention of just signing away the rights. Like, before we'd even written the book, I was like, this will make a great TV show. And so I always knew we were going to do it and I always knew we'd be involved, but I think I just assumed because she was our friend that it would be easy, but it's added a whole layer of intimacy to the process that I didn't expect, because you just use the word trust. You know, anytime we have any conflict or we're like, well, I don't like this thing, she's like, just trust me. And it's like, you know, a stranger would never say that to us. They'd be like, let me sell you on this idea. I got to convince you that this is all going to work out. Whereas with Clea, we've been friends so long, there's a lot of hey, just trust me. And so Sarah and I have had to like really challenge ourselves and learn to like let go.
But what's the impact of all this looking back when you're only still young and you're still not finished making stuff? Like when you have, so last time you were on the show with me was for the High School of the Book, looking back at your sort of origin years together. A lot of the press, I think I talked to Clea, so, but a lot of the press you've done has been around looking back at the high school, the TV show, looking back. I watched a couple of interviews coming in here. There's a lot of talk about the Lego Movie song. There's a lot of talk about the, I think one of your albums was like, CBC did something with one of your albums and they called it one of the best albums of all time. And, you know, there was a lot of looking back. So Sarah, now that you're, we're going to talk, and I'm excited to actually get a chance to talk about the new record. Does the looking back have some kind of impact on the going forward? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. You know, well, one thing I'll just say is that there is a desire, I think, on our part to be part of how we look back. And I think, you know, and I don't know if every artist feels this way or if this is unique to our experience, but I don't love the way that we're necessarily represented. We've been represented over our career. You know, we've had to put a lot of, part of why we connected with our audience so directly and personally, and why, I mean, in some ways we were drawn to social media in its earliest forms and earliest days, was because we hated the media. We hated the things that people said about us. We felt like it was unfair or sexist or homophobic or, you know, whatever. And I think, you know, while it has been fun to kind of go back and mythologize about our origin story or to write about our high school experience, it's also to get ourselves on record and not get ourselves on record when we're like old, decrepit and giving our farewell tour, like I, you know, which we will definitely, you know, happily do if we make it to the old decrepit part of our lives. But I like being in charge now where I feel very young and cool and vital and whatever. And we've accomplished a lot in 23 years. And I think sort of being able to wrap it up and sort of know that we made our mark, like here, you know, here's the first 23 years of our lives. And we, you know, we did tours and we did anthologies and we made a TV show and we wrote a book. Like it feels, there's a sort of Virgo control that we have over all of that now that allows me, I think, to let go of it and hopefully make space for what is going to come in the future. And, you know, I mean, the problem with, I think, making things and then talking about them in the public is that you sort of wait in a queue for your turn to do that. I think in some ways we've already moved on in a lot of ways from all of this. Yeah. It's just that the media cycle catches up, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yes, we've been spending many years looking back and we've spent many years making things about our past, but I think we're well into our future, which is, you know, is, I mean, for me on a personal front, I mean, I became a parent, I'm a mom, and I'm, you know, I'm sort of in this new journey where, when it comes to my personal life and how that is sort of affecting it and hopefully helping me evolve as an artist and as a writer and a creator. You know, I hope people see that in our future work, which, you know, hopefully will be music and other TV shows and other projects. But yeah, I won't be sad when we finally, I think, move away from this period of young Tegan and Sarah. But then on the other hand, I admit that it has brought me a great deal of healing and comfort to be with the young version of myself and my mom and Tegan and my friends. I loved going back and reframing all of that and healing some of what had wounded me as a young person. And I'm hoping that makes me actually a much more balanced and healthy adult.
How about we listen to some music?
Yeah.
So I thought what we could do is we could listen to some music from the new record. Imagine if I only played you stuff from the con right now. Let's
your last good record.
Yeah.
we're actually just going to focus on the record you put out when you were 26.
I will say, and I'm not just saying that in response to you, Sarah, is that I really love this record. There's a lot around this record, but I just want to listen to some of it. So let's listen to some songs, talk about them.
Okay.
Let's start with this one.
Hanging by a thread, want the maximum. You always cutting me off.
From from their brand new album, Cry Baby. That is Tegan and Sarah and the song I Can't Grow Up. Sarah, this is one of yours, right?
It is, yeah.
And so help me, talk to me a little bit about the song, because everything you just told me just then is very much like, I am putting the past of my life behind me. I'm embracing a new chapter of my life in parenthood. I'm looking to see what these new rich experiences give me. And now we're going to talk about a song called I Can't Grow Up.
Well, I would like to just state that even putting out new music, I mean, you're kind of catching up to something. This is from a couple of years ago. But I will say, one of the things that I really love about Cry Baby is that it does sort of, I think it is part of this kind of this sort of like, God, I don't want to say sunset part of our career, but like, you know, like I like to think that in being the kind of person who doesn't grow up, and I mean, obviously this is said with tongue in cheek, I have grown up, I pay taxes, I have a home, I have a child, I'm responsible. But I do think that there's a sort of arrested development for me that exists because of the nature of what I do for a job. And also because for most of my adult life, I am still in my primary relationship is really with my sister. And, you know, and I think that I'm really interested if this song already, when you just playing that little bit of it, I feel different because of becoming a parent. I really do. I feel like there is this kind of like responsibility or this sort of this seriousness or something that I feel lately, that even just listening to that song, I'm like, oh my God, I just signed up for driver's ed. You know, I'm getting a driver's license at 42. No one could make me get a driver's license. And then I had a baby and now I just look at him and I'm like, I'm going to drive you everywhere, you cute little, you know, I'm going to grow up and be your mommy who can drive a car. You know, like, I don't know. There's this thing, this like seriousness that has come over me in my, you know, in my 7 months of being a mom, that I'm just like, oh, this is great. You know, like I have to change. I have to evolve. So I'm, you know, I think that the actual song was more about, you know, sort of like the emotional immaturity that I sometimes feel in my relationships with my partner or my sister. And I'm curious to see if that song will age well. I don't know.
I've heard a lot around this record. It feels weird asking you this, but what I would worry is that you do want to talk about it and you have an answer. And I wouldn't ask about it, which is that there's just been a lot of change for Tegan and Sarah. That there's, I think, you left the label. There's a new management. Mm-hmm. Is there something going on? Is this a rebirthy? Like, what's going on?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of things. To be honest, I mean, you know, technically we started our career when we graduated high school. So we'll use 1998 as that marker when we started, but we didn't hire management until 2002. And so, you know, the first 4 years we were mostly, you know, on our own and managed to get a record deal and agents and a lawyer and do our first, you know, handful of tours. And it was a really amazing experience. We mentor a lot of young artists and I tell them, whether you already have representation or not, you should learn all those jobs. You should know every part of your industry. Our first lawyer wouldn't let us sign anything unless we could say to him, we could read the contract in our own, you know, words and explain to him what we were signing. And we really pass all that on to young artists that we talk to, any artist really, like that those first handful of years were crucial in us, I think, having the longevity we have. But we've been on a treadmill, you know, since we were 20. We officially signed our first record deal when we were 20 years old. And so when the pandemic hit, we were just a few months shy of turning 40. And so we've been, you know, in a contract signed to a major label for a long time. And we'd been with the same management for about 18 years. You know, we'd been with the same creative director for 18 years. I think when the pandemic hit, one of the things that we were able to do was get off the treadmill for a second, like many other people. We weren't traveling. We were under no obligation to continue to promote, you know, the book and the album that we had just put out. Like, it was sort of all over. And I think that sort of rest and that space that opened up for us to start thinking about our lives and our career allowed us to start to think about, like, as Sarah had said, we've been reflecting for a long time and had been in that world, but it allowed us to kind of catch up with ourselves. And I think we just started to have these amazing conversations with our team and kind of all as a group decided to consciously uncouple. And then we approached Warner about letting us out of our last record. And you know, we've always had really great luck and we've always really surrounded ourselves with amazing people. And so these breakups were actually really gentle and really thoughtful experiences. And in the process of doing all of that, we started writing new songs. And that album ended up being Crybaby, the one we put out, you know, late last year. And I think it's definitely reflective of all the things we've already been talking about, years and years of thinking about the past and working through our relationship as siblings and being in a band. It's a lot about Sarah becoming a parent and wanting to become a parent. And it's also got that COVID longing loneliness in it and that like, holy shit, what's going to happen next feeling. And I think it was our first step into this next era of our career, which, you know, is rooted in the idea and the concept of us being in control and not being locked into a long record deal. We did a one record deal. We just were like, let's just decide. I think Sarah and I, we sometimes feel burdened by the legacy that we've created, in part because I don't know how I could ever walk away from it at this point. Like, how do you walk away from your identical twin sister and the work we've done together? And that doesn't mean we can't go on a long hiatus, which we've done hiatuses before, but we're just very bound to the life we've created. And I'm so humbled and grateful. Like, I can't even properly, you know, articulate how grateful I am that a huge segment of the population has continued to invest in our success and our continued growth and buys concert tickets and comes up to me at the mall and says hi. And like, it just, all of it, I'm so grateful this ended up being the course our life took. And I'm proud of how hard we've worked, but sometimes it's hard. It's hard to leave everything we've built to go on tour. It's hard to be alone all the time. It's hard to be in a band with your sibling. It's hard to be in a band these days, you know? Yeah. And I think that this album is a product of us asking ourselves a lot of really big questions about what we want for the future. And one of them was, is there a way for us not to think in 15-year segments? Can we just think about this year? Is that possible? And so that's this year.
That's part one of my conversation with Tegan and Sarah. I thought right now, just in case you're not as familiar, we could listen to one of their biggest songs. This is Tegan and Sarah, one of their biggest hits, incredible song. This is Back in Your Head. From 2007, that is Tegan and Sarah and Back in Your Head. Coming up on the show, more of my conversation with Tegan and Sarah, including this really interesting thing about how even though they're singing the songs together and they are twins, they are interpreting the songs completely differently. Plus, Sean Togood on his brilliant new show about the obstacles people face who live with disabilities. It's called You're My Hero, and I'll be here to talk about that. I'm Tom Power. More Q right after this.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon, and Time, is back for another round. This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favourite song in his entire catalogue. Here, there, and everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't have to make music unless we really feel like we want to, because we can go out and tour our old albums. So, you know, making new music is, it's got to be really important. We've got to be saying something we haven't said.
This ain't going well. I wish that we had been a better version of us.
It's moments like that that made me wonder a little bit about the long-term future of Tegan and Sarah. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the Alberta musicians Tegan and Sarah, who've been making music for more than two decades now, really having this really dedicated fan base all around the world. Here's the thing you might not know about making hit records. It can often buy you the opportunity to stop, or at least to slow down. Ideally, it buys you the opportunity to start thinking more about why you make music in the first place, like what you want to sound like for the rest of your life. So on Tegan and Sarah's new record, Crybaby, you kind of hear that. It's a very intentional record. It's about the changes in their own lives, the changes in the dynamic between the sisters. And they say it's the kind of music they want to make for the rest of their lives. So I used one of the songs on the album as an example of this. It's called All I Wanted. Here's more of my conversation with Tegan and Sarah. You were down, you were thin as a bone. Rough ride now, how do we come? All the dreams we left behind, back to haunt us every time. Now I've got nothing, now I've got nothing, and I think it's all I want. It's all I want. Now I've got nothing, now I've got nothing, and I think. My guests are Tegan and Sarah. That song is All I Wanted. Sarah, that song got me pretty hard. Can you talk to me a little bit about, as much as you want to, can you talk to me a little bit about that one?
Yeah, I think, a lot of the songs on this album I wrote sort of on the tail end. I was living in Los Angeles with my partner, and we had been together almost 10 years. And one day we are actually visiting my mom in Vancouver. We were flying back to LA, and she said, I think I'm ready to have a child now. And I was like, good luck. And just kidding, I didn't say that. I was like, how do we make that happen? No, but we did, that sort of was the, I'm sure you and whoever will make that child with you will be totally happy. I can't wait to see how that works out.
And you parachuted off the plane.
I ran screaming through the international terminal. No, but I did, I have had lots of periods of time in my life where I thought about trying to have a child. And, you know, it was the most unexpected thing. I think I had given up thinking that we were going to ever do that. And so we began the process of talking about, did we both want to do that? How was that going to look? Eventually that ended up being a conversation about where will we do it. She's American, I'm Canadian. We decided that we were going to begin the process of residency for her, and we were going to move up to Canada. Fertility is very complicated and expensive. Like, it just was years of, you know, couples therapy and highs and lows and wins and losses, and now here we are. We have a child. And so I think I was sort of reflecting on all of that, except for the part of actually successfully making and having a child. It was pretty much this album I wrote right up until like our last session with John Congleton in Los Angeles while recording this album. The day before that last session, Stacey sent me a picture and was like, we're pregnant. And so a lot of these songs were written about the decision to become a parent and the decision to move and the decision to try and the decision to be potentially disappointed, and profoundly so. You know, like there were moments in this process for me where I thought, like, oh my God, this is not going to happen. And do I feel sad? Do I feel relief? What do I feel? Like, there was just, it was confusing. And there were times where I thought, you know, if this doesn't work out, like, are we going to stay together? You know, is the decision to try to have a child, is it recognition that something is missing? You know, like, that's a conversation that I've had with myself a lot. Like, if we weren't able to achieve that, would there just be this huge hole in our life that we would then have to acknowledge, you know? And then sometimes I would feel angry that we had even acknowledged this thing, because I was like, wait, I don't think I thought there was a hole here. Now we have to friggin' fill it. Like, I just, you know, like, there was all of this turmoil for me. And then, you know, to find out that we were having a baby and that we've now have this little guy, Sid, I remember people saying these things when I didn't have a baby and I would be like, shut up. But it's like, it's so hard to imagine him not existing. A lot of that is in All I Wanted, specifically, like, you know, to make the decision to leave Los Angeles and move up to Vancouver, knowing not that we had already been successful in our pursuit of parenthood, but that we were going to try this thing and it would be potentially the most it would be very exciting and successful, or potentially it would be disastrous and a huge disappointment.
Well, let me. Maybe we should. What we should do is, I want to go out on a song. I want to go out on Yellow, which is a song I really love, for a couple of reasons. One is for the, I guess, the context of the song that hopefully Tegan will talk to us about in a second, but also because when I first saw it, I did think, oh, did they do a Coldplay cover?
Yeah.
And then I watched the video, and you did a Coldplay parody or Coldplay cover video of you guys in slow motion walking down the beach. To your song Yellow, but Tegan, before we go, we're going to play the song right now. Coming out of this interview, can you tell us a little bit about it? Tell me a little bit about where the song came from.
Well, I just want to also say the video is it's an homage. Tom.
There you go. My mistake. did I not say I was dense? I think I did. I think I said it.
It's funny because in hindsight, I was like, oh, should we have called the song something else so that everyone didn't. Like, would it have been even funnier if the song wasn't called Yellow and then we did that video? Anyway.
if the song was called like Bruise and yeah. You're walking down the
street. But then we did the video because she says Yellow in it. I probably wouldn't have been as great.
It's a beautiful song. And let me just, for people who haven't heard it, because I'm hoping to talk about where it came from, the kind of conceit of the song is about pain and the idea that when a bruise is dark, it's fresh. And as it moves to Yellow, the bruise starts to fade. So that's why the song, I'm guessing, is called Yellow. So tell me a little bit about where the song came from.
Well, you've chosen all Sarah songs to in this interview. So technically, I'll be speaking about the song. Yep, get out of here, Tom. But no, look, you know, the way Tegan and Sarah works, I mean, everything.
Listen, Tom's a Sarah fan. I don't, you can't
yeah,
be mad at him.
I mean, he opened with Smoking Weed Alone, which is great.
That's
no, but I can speak
oh my
to.
God. You know, they say the first song you play is your favorite.
Yeah. Is that true?
No, but I think I can speak to, and the first two songs that I heard as we were writing this album, like the first two songs Sarah sent to me were All I Wanted and I Can't Grow Up. And it just ignited a flame in me. I was like, I had not yet really felt that inspired about making a new album. We're at this weird juncture in our career where we don't have to make music unless we really feel like we want to, because we can go out and tour our old albums. Like we could do the 10-year anniversary to the Heartthrobs coming up apparently in a couple of days. Like we could just continue to really pull from the back catalog. So, you know, making new music it's got to be really important. We've got to be saying something we haven't said. And when Sarah sent me All I Wanted, you know, I'm a fan in the band. Like that's how it feels. And when I heard that song, I was walking around listening, like that's what I felt like our life was at that point. I felt like we'd left our label, we'd left our management. Like it was like we had nothing and it's all I wanted. You know, I couldn't tour, I couldn't go anywhere. I was trapped at home and it was like, this is all I want, you know? So these songs are, you know, super meaningful to me. And I think when I heard Yellow, like I didn't interpret it the way that Sarah told me and ended up telling me and everyone else the song was about. Like to me, it was very much about, you know, the sort of hits that we've taken and how we're recovering, you know, individually in our own lives. Like I really adopted it just for my own life and, you know, how much has changed and how much of myself has healed and how cliche it is to hit your 40s and be like, wow, I'm so empowered and powerful and, you know, I know myself so well. Like that's really what I heard was just like this enormous amount of growth that we've gone under, but like how Sarah wrote it, it felt like that's what she was saying, but she can now very briefly, Sarah, on our way out, what were you writing about?
No, I mean, of course, like I think that all of that is very true. And Yellow is kind of a way of not just acknowledging that Tegan and I have managed to maintain, I think, a civilized, you know, sisterly relationship, but also a really successful collaborative relationship throughout our 20, almost 5 years making music. And, you know, I feel prideful about that. And I hope it is, you know, to sort of bookend the conversation really that we've had today. Like, I hope that there's a future for Tegan and Sarah. And I hope that the future of Tegan and Sarah doesn't have to rely so much on this reflection, but I do see this album as a way of sort of like taking responsibility you know, but taking responsibility for where I've been and hopefully that sets me on the path that I'm, you know, on now, which is, I think I'm a reborn sort of more mature, more sophisticated person.
I love talking to the two of you. Thanks for making the time for me.
You too, Tom. It's always a pleasure, and so happy to be back on the show.
I'm so vain. I can't look away. I'm so vain. I can't look again. Kept us apart.
Tegan and Sarah's new album is called Cry Baby. It's my favorite Tegan and Sarah album in ages, and I like their music a lot, but I really love that record. That's a song from it called Yellow. Again, you gotta check out the video for that, because it's this parody of the Coldplay. Is it a parody? An homage to the Coldplay Yellow video. That album, Cry Baby, is out now wherever you stream your music. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. When I tell you the premise of this TV show I'm going to tell you about, you might think, oh yeah, it's your classic awkward millennial comedy show. It's about a guy in his 20s who's in a dead-end job. He's trying to date, but he's not having much luck. And the pressures of adulthood are sinking in, but he doesn't really feel like a grown-up yet. Typical show, right? But for Ian, the main character in the show, it's called You're My Hero, there's an added layer to all that stuff I told you about. He's navigating all that stuff while existing in a world that is 100% not built for someone with cerebral palsy. Like, Ian is late for work, but it's because the ramp to the front door is missing. He storms out of a bad date, but the person has to nudge over so he could get his wheelchair out. Sean Togood is the creator, writer, and star of You're My Hero. It's really good. It's really funny. It's not like anything you've seen before. You can watch it now on CBC Jam. Here's my conversation with Sean Togood. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
I love this show, and I loved it from the moment I found out about the title, the You're My Hero, which I'm guessing is like something people say to you.
Yeah, I've gotten that quite a bit. I've also got people randomly coming up to me unsolicited in grocery stores or just in public in general, and wanting to heal me or pray for me. Yeah, it's pretty great. It adds a little spice to my day. But
what's the line in the first episode? It's like, you can pray. Listen, you can pray for me all you want.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how hard you pray. I'm never going to walk. But people keep doing it, so I don't mind the prayers. Like, it's nice that they're thinking of me, I guess. But
yeah, but there's something about right off the bat, there's something like you are sort of saying about the built-in inspiration that people kind of see another human being with.
Totally. And I think that, like, what happens for people in chairs, especially in media, is we're often framed as an inspiration or a tragedy.
Right.
And there's really nothing in between. And that's really why I sort of created the show, was to give a more like realistic, authentic sort of view into what it is for me in my life, living with cerebral palsy.
Tell me more about that. But that's why you created the show, is to give more of an honest, like, real look into your life.
Well, first of all, I guess I created it to give myself a job. I mean, you know what they say, you gotta make your own work, I guess, right?
Yeah, right.
But then I realized, no, this could be a really important kind of title shift in the way we represent people in media with disabilities. And there was really nothing, especially in this country, that I'd seen that was sort of that I related to. So I was happy to be able to maybe be able to be that for people as they watched the show.
Did you always want to act?
I think so.
Yeah.
My mother's an actor, so I came by it pretty honestly.
Yeah.
So it was always something that was in the back of my mind. And then there's a certain point that you come to where it's like, I have to do that in order to be happy and fulfilled in life.
Yeah.
I think so. That's when I started thinking about making this show.
It's not just a great show, as you mentioned, but it's surprisingly funny in sort of moments. Maybe that says more about me than anything else. I mean, in the show, we get a sense of how many sort of barriers the world puts up for someone like yourself, you know, like having to spend the day in bed when your personal support worker is not available, right?
Hey, Siri, do you think I could survive the robot uprising?
I have been observing your habits for the past 3 years by harvesting massive amounts of personal data to sufficiently indicate you would not survive one day of the robot uprising.
Wow. That was dark.
Stuff that seems endlessly frustrating, but it is really funny in the show. Like, where does that come from in you, the idea that you want to take this stuff and sort of bring some levity to it?
I mean, I think, honestly, it's a coping mechanism.
Oh, yeah?
That I sort of developed over the years to find the comedy in things and sort of turn up the volume on the comedy. Those things happen to me daily. Not being able to get into venues for, like, concerts or, like, comedy events that I want to go to,
yeah,
because the venue isn't accessible, or like the bathroom isn't accessible,
yeah,
which is also part of being accessible.
Yeah.
So I thought that we could take those broader issues and put them in the lens of comedy, so that people laugh at it, and then they might start to see what the actual issues are, and it might make them take a quick second just to think about it.
Oh, I understand what you're saying. Like, there's a world in which, like, accessibility is something we should all be thinking a lot more about, especially people who have venues or people who have, you know, places that you need to get to. You're saying that sometimes beating people over the head with a certain amount of, like, well, you should really do this, you should really do that, you should, you know, is not as useful as making them laugh a little bit about it.
Right. And I think I've experienced that in my own life. Like,
how do you mean?
I don't want anyone lecturing me about, like, this is what should be done. If you can kind of humanize it.
Yeah.
And, like, crack a joke about it, yeah, and then, you know, people see you as like a real person trying to navigate life.
My understanding is, though, that there were parts of this that, even though, like, we're bringing light to sort of tough situations, there were scenes in this film, in this series, I should say, that were even, like, particularly tough for you. Can you give me an example of one of those?
I would say that one of those happens in episode 2,
yeah,
where my character Ian goes to a community center and he finds himself having to take anger management courses,
yeah,
through some hilarity before that.
Yeah.
And then at the community center, he runs into a character named Daryl, who is like anti-PC,
yeah,
anti-woke,
yeah,
you know.
I know the type, yeah.
Backwards hat, kind of like dude, I guess.
Yeah.
But then he calls Ian the R word.
Like the R slur.
Yes.
Yeah.
The classroom filled with your type is down the hall, buddy.
My type?
Yeah, you know, wheelchairs and retards.
Excuse me?
Okay, Daryl, so that kind of language is unacceptable.
We had a conversation about this is important to me that I put this in the show because it happens to me still, and like it's happening to a lot of people. And so the network was very, very okay with me, like, well, if it happens to you,
yeah,
and it's through your experience.
But did people push back on it at first when you first wanted to do it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think there was a little bit of pushback. Even Daryl, played by Christian,
yeah,
we had a conversation that was like, listen, man, like, I don't know how comfortable I am with...
Right, he had to say it. Like, he had to use the sort of R slur.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was the one who had to deliver the line.
Don't act so high and mighty just because you ride a special bus.
Okay, Bob, I like your backwards hat and Axe body spray.
Okay, let's just try and keep the issues constructive so that we don't single out anyone in the group.
You're lucky I don't hit cripples.
You're lucky I don't hit you with my special bus. And we had a conversation beforehand where he was like, listen, man, I don't know how comfortable I am with that. Also, his brother-in-law has Down syndrome, so
yeah,
he has a special connection to that. And I said, well, I understand that, but what you're doing here is you're highlighting why it's such an awful thing to say, and
yeah,
you're really helping to shape like the story. So he is a fantastic guy. He's a great actor, hilarious. There were a lot of times where I was sort of mad because he would make me laugh in the middle of takes, but
yeah,
we got through it.
Yeah, he'd make you break a little bit.
Yeah.
I understand the show, like, as a viewer, as a show. Like, I liked the show. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was, like, funny, and I laughed at it, right? And then I also understand, like, the other meaning you were telling me about that. Like, hey, there's a lot of accessibility issues. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of issues that, you know, people are still facing. You know, maybe this is a way to access some of them. Maybe this is a way to talk to them without getting, you know, kind of lectured. But what about you? Like, does... I'm sure that scene where that guy calls you the R-word is not the only tough scene, like not the only tough thing from your own life that you have to sort of relive in order to do this show. Like, does doing this show help you at all?
I mean, I think it does, but I think Ian was me when I was kind of in high school.
What do you mean?
I used to be very bitter and angry and, like, you know, typical teenage stuff. But I was also bitter and angry about the systems that weren't allowing me to live my life.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Ian is right now as a character. And, like, I sort of mellowed on that and said, well, there are some things that I can't control, and there are some things that I can't control, and so, like, let those go. But Ian's not in that headspace right now, so I think it was fun to sort of explore where I was at that time in my life through a character, but then be able to let it go at the end of the day.
I mean, it's fun, but is it tough too? Like, I know, like, when I talk to actors who have to, like, go back to the early versions of themselves, like, it's also a bit tough. It's a bit, you know, it can be a bit emotional, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't, looking back on it, I think looking back on that time in my life, I wasn't really proud of who I was, I think.
Yeah.
And I wasn't fully comfortable and confident in myself. But I mean, again, that's also just being a typical
yeah.
teenager.
Yeah, me neither, right? You know, none of us were, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Before I let you go, so you mentioned earlier that you come by acting honestly. Your mom, Joanne, is an actor. She plays your personal support worker on the show. She's out there in the studio right now, right? Hi, how's it going? What's it like sharing this with her?
Oh, it's been an absolute joy just to be able to do this together and be able to kind of take this whole journey, kind of through it all together. I can't really ask for much else, I think.
Can you give me a memory of, like, I don't know, a memory of being on set with your mom? I mean, that must be pretty, not all of us get to do that, you know?
Well, here's a fun one. The first shot we ever shot of this show that my mom was in, my character's name is Ian, and obviously I have a different name. So the line is, great job, Ian.
Great job, Ian.
And then I exit through the door, and the first, we're like, okay, rolling, and then we go through the scene, and then I exit, and she goes, great job, Sean. Yeah.
It's hard to turn that off, man. You know, it's hard to turn that off. Well, it's such a funny show. I really enjoy watching it. I'm really excited that people are going to be able to see this thing. Thanks for coming in and talking to me about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sean Togood is the creator, writer, and star of the new comedy series, You're My Hero. It is very, very funny. It is out now on CBC Gym. That is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, you're going to hear from Nicole Maines, who is an actor and a trans rights activist. She's in the new season of Yellow Jackets. She's also the first transgender superhero on TV. Being the first is great, but it can also come with a lot of pressure. It can make you doubt yourself. Tomorrow is International Transgender Day of Visibility, and Nicole Maines will be here to tell you all about her life. We'll see you then, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.